That was the opening of Une Bach Solution from Ravel's Miroir, and it was performed by Jean-Eflamme Bavuzet. I'm Erica Wirth, and welcome to this pianist podcast. Today, I am speaking to Jean-Eflamme about all things Ravel and lots more. Jean-Eflamme, it's so great to have you on the pianist podcast
Same
today.
here, same here.
Oh, it's wonderful. And I thought, seeing we're still in the Ravel anniversary year, 150 years of his birth, we should discuss first your Ravel Complete Works for Solo Piano, which came out earlier this year on Shandels. Tell me about it. How come it's taken you so long to do the complete works of Ravel?
Well, you mean because I recorded it 20 years ago, or a little more actually, for a German label, MDG, and on a very old Steinway that was actually difficult to master somehow, but the sound was absolutely gorgeous. But it was a heavy instrument, and as you know, Ravel has a lot of repeated notes and floating arpeggios, and oh, I remember struggling a lot. And but it was a kind of major step for me as a musician, but also in my career, I must say, because it somehow put my name on the map, and then I continue to work on that repertoire and play that repertoire constantly. Actually, probably Ravel is one of the very first composers I ever played. Even I mean when I was able to master the jeu d'eau or the toccata, yes, and a composer with whom I had always affinity in the sense that. And don't ask me why, but I felt very close to his mix. Somehow, even now, I know much more about his life than I did, of course, 40 years ago. For, that comes without saying. But I always had the feeling that I understand his, that I can grab his style and the way he wanted his music to sound. Maybe as an illusion, I don't know. But I was always rather convinced how his music should be played. On the contrary, Debussy was a huge enigma for me. And oh yes, and it took me long time to grasp the style of Debussy, much longer. But Ravel was always kind of immediate. So I continue to play his music, and many times actually all his music in one concert, which makes it a long
Goodness.
concert, but still possible. And then came this anniversary year, and I thought, okay, why not going back to the recording studio? And doing that this time, not on an old instrument, but on a brand new CFX Yamaha, with whom I have, of course, a very close relation, having done all my almost past 40 recordings with them. And we find finally a very good instrument that fitted. Actually, we find two that fitted my so-called ideal and desire, and of course they have a wonderful action. The Yamaha action is like Rolls-Royce. I mean, you can do absolutely everything you want with this light, precise, and so well regulated. And Yamaha even sent three tuners, one from Japan, and two pianos, and four actions. I mean, they were really. It was incredible the luxury I had,
Oh my
and
goodness.
I constantly do, I must say. So that was very good. And then the thing is. That some people, including some reviews, said, "Oh, Mr. Bavuzet changed a lot in his approach of Ravel." That was, it was very strange for me because actually, the difference between the two recordings, I must say, I didn't hear the first one before I was doing the second one. I was not doing okay. I'm now thinking I'm going to do something different than I did 20 years ago. No, that was not my purpose. My purpose was to have another complete Ravel experience in the studio. But my point of view didn't change a bit Absolutely not. Up to a
No.
point that at some time I said, but is it really necessary to record the whole thing? Because I'm sure my playing is about the same as as it was. And believe it or not, it's not. It's not,
No.
but not at all. First of all, the sound environment is completely different, of course, because of the first, because of the instruments and also the surrounding and the sound and everything. But it's just the time passing, and probably between the two recordings there are, I don't know, 50, 80, maybe 100 of performance between them. And of course it adds a kind of patine. How do you would explain that in English? The time is making a difference,
Of course.
and of course you evolve as a musician. And I must say, reading all I know now about Ravel, I may have changed, but not with my decision to make something different at all. I don't think my position changed. Anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I was really happy also, thanks to the idea of Ralph Cousins to add the walls, which I was not thinking of doing, because as you know, the Ralph the valse is a
Yes.
transcription of an orchestra piece.
Yeah, la valse,
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly, la valse. But no, I was very, very, very happy to do it. And now, of course, it's a real joy to present to the audience, which I've done many times this year and still continue, his complete works of you know, I was thinking the entire output of
Yes.
Ravel is more or less three Wagner operas. That's all there is.
Whoa.
So his piano music, his entire piano music is
Yes.
actually a long concert of 2 hours, 20 minutes of music. That's all. So,
Absolutely. You have it on one release. You
exactly.
know, I'm trying to think how many minutes it is in total. Where does it
Well,
say?
it's exactly 2 hours and
Yes,
20.
exactly. No, listen, and I, yeah.
Including La Valse, you know, which is
Yeah,
30
of
minutes.
course. Of course. And I see, of course, you are playing it all around at the start of the season. You're going to Australia, Japan, America, Spain. Playing Ravel, yes.
Oh yes, but I did I just did it last week in the wonderful Lammermoor Festival in Scotland. Wonderful place, like
Yes.
one of the best kept secrets of England. It's really marvelous, marvelous place.
Lammermoor, yeah.
And you have 500 people at three times, sometimes even four times per day. And so yes, it's a non-stop feast of mixing unknown music and young people, more advanced performer, and so it's a
Yes.
great, great, great place. And so
Oh.
I did that there too, and
Yes.
I'm going to do it in New York, and as you said, Japan, Australia, and I was at the Verbier. I opened the Verbier Festival. I mean, it's a lot of things. Yes.
I hear you were also at Bravo Vale in Colorado a week before I was there. Did you play, what did you play there? The Ravel
I
concerto?
played Ravel Left Hand with the wonderful Philadelphia Orchestra and
Oh.
Stéphane Deneuve. Yes, that was really marvelous.
Oh,
That was
fantastic.
marvelous. And we had something funny because just before we came on stage, a big storm came out.
Oh.
Yeah, and as you know, the piece is half outdoors, and you have, I think,
Yes.
Almost 2,000 people covered, but the three other or three four other thousands are in on the grass. So it was a kind of shaky. We waited, and finally we made the intermission, and then we played. Yeah, and we played with a kind of 40 minutes delay. But that's look, that's
Oh,
that. It's inevitable. But
part of the fun, part of the
nevertheless,
fun.
it was really great, really great.
Fantastic. Now, what I found interesting about you touched on Debussy, saying that Ravel, you had a better inclination towards. Most people would say the opposite, wouldn't they? They start with Debussy. It you know,
Are you
whereas Ravel
sure?
seems so difficult in a
Are
way.
you sure, Erica? I think I'm not sure, because on the pure, let's say, fame, Ravel is more known than Debussy,
Is
probably
more,
also
sorry.
because he's more known. No.
Known.
Or, I mean, the bolero is a phenomenal, it's a phenomenon of classical music, okay? It's probably the most known a piece of classical music.
Bolero.
Yeah, the bolero, right?
Wait.
Well, it was for many years the biggest income of the SACEM, Société des auteurs-compositeurs of music in France for many, many years, all with all genres. I mean,
Wow.
pop, rock. It was the bolero who was bringing the most amount at the time when it was still under copyright, which is not, no.
Yes.
But as
Yeah.
we speak, Erika, there is always 24/7 an orchestra playing the bolero on the planet,
Oh my
live,
goodness.
live. Yes, I'm not sure you can say that even for Beethoven Fifth Symphony
No.
or Tchaikovsky Fifth or you know there is nothing. So the bolero is a really completely enormous. I say commercial success. Don't get me wrong. It's not. I mean it's the paradox.
Yeah.
What I want to say is that Ravel didn't consider that music composition at all. Ravel considered that an exercise, and I can really understand because, well, that goes probably a little too technical. But composition is not so much having great ideas; is how do you go from one idea to the other, and how you combine them. That's where the challenge of a composer is. Now, to have a piece of music where you just have one single idea that you repeat, I think, 17 times, and you just change the orchestration, is almost like an exercise of orchestration. You see what I mean?
It's phenomenal. I
Yes.
would say this, and there's a minimalistic quality to
Yes,
it.
and of course not to underestimate also its erotic power. Actually, I was just
Oh, very.
finishing the last Dan Brown book yesterday night, and I was really very very happy to see that Mr. Brown is mentioning the bolero, and yes, and obviously he had listened to the score and know had the score because he knew the second instrument was the clarinet after 17 bars. So anyway,
Oh.
it's a very well-known piece. So
Yeah.
what I mean to go back to the difference between Debussy and Ravel. Apart of the bolero, which is a really concept piece, Ravel is a very classic composer.
Yes.
He used classic harmonies, he used classical form. You can hum many themes of Ravel. Now, can you hum anything of Debussy? No. Debussy is atmospheric. Debussy changed almost the rules of how to compose at each piece he wrote. Debussy doesn't
Yeah.
apply any classical pattern. His harmonies defy sometimes analyzing. So
Yeah.
Debussy is, in a way, although he didn't claim to be a revolutionary, but he is, regardless of what he say of himself, he
Yeah.
is. And Ravel is a classical composer.
Interesting.
So I think you, when you refer to the people loving Debussy, you think probably of only Clair de Lune and La Fille aux cheveux de lin. That's the
Wait.
two pieces, you know, the but all his other pieces, like the Etudes, like Jeux, like
Right.
the Images. I mean, they are music very difficult to grasp,
Yeah.
and to grasp, sorry, and to read. How what do you do with all these indications and how you digest them I mean, don't forget that sometimes in the etudes he has eight different possibilities. He's telling the pianist eight different possibilities to hit the keys.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Oh
Now,
my
Ravel
gosh.
is very precise too, and we know that Ravel didn't want any personal initiative from his. He said, "Play the score as written. Please do not add anything." Okay, good. But so you more or less you play the Ravel music in the tempo he asked for, and you rather play them straightforward, and it sounds good. With
Yeah.
Debussy, it's another world. Instead, completely the other world. To make another comparison, I think
Yeah.
Ravel for me is like the fairy garden, le jardin féerique of the
Oui.
last piece of his Ma Mère Loire, four hands he wrote for children.
Yes.
I think this piece alone encapsulates the entire power and poesy of Ravel music. Ravel music for me is a fairy garden. Debussy deals with cosmic force.
Fantastic.
Debussy deals with force that are far behind our even our. It's, for me, it's cosmic. Although the piece he wrote are small. I use always to make the comparison that La fille aux cheveux de lin is roughly the length of the first theme of Parsifal.
Okay.
You see, but the two composers, Wagner and Debussy, have this thing in common that using completely different techniques. Debussy using little brush and Wagner using long line, but actually both composers succeed to build some unbearable tensions.
Yes.
And I will not make this comparison with Ravel. Ravel for me is more like Mozart.
Well, maybe now we could talk about Mozart or we'll be here all day. It's so lovely, but from Ravel to Mozart. And I've just received your volume 11 of your wonderful Mozart series with the Manchester Camerata and Gabor Takash Nagy.
No, Erika, please.
Oui.
Nudge.
Oh, it's so difficult. Nudge.
Since I know you, you are always saying, no. But like many people, nudge means big in Hungarian.
Nudge.
Kish is small and nudge is big. So you forgot the Y. Every time you have a Y at the end of a Hungarian name, you never say E. You say nudge.
Nudge. Gabor Takash Nudge.
Nudge. Perfect.
Perfect.
Actually,
okay,
if you want,
thank you.
If you really want to be perfect, you should say Takash Nudge Gabor. Because in Hungarian as well as in Korean, you say the family name before.
Well, I'll practice that after this podcast. but I believe next spring sees the last one of the series. So I guess that's volume 12, isn't it, in total?
Yes, which is already recorded and which will have the two concertos Mozart wrote for several pianos, the one for two pianos and for three pianos. And the second piano was played by my dear wife, Andrea Nemetz. Nemetz Andrea.
Oh, she's Hungarian.
She's Hungarian, and she was taught in the best tradition of Middle European in Vienna and in Budapest first, and then in Vienna, and I'm a pianist myself, of course, and then I must say I really learned a great deal. I mean, we are together since 43 years, right?
Aww.
So we had a lot to a lot of time to discuss, but I learned a great deal about and I had wonderful teachers at the Paris Conservatory, absolutely no doubt, but I was not taught about phrasing. You see, most of the pianists I even hear even today are playing let's say the classical style, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, even Schubert, with like a bow of 50 meters long bow, so to speak.
Okay.
A pianist, I mean, you know, as if the violinist had a 50 meters long bow, and you don't hear the change of bow. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some violinists may say, what he just said? Of course, you don't need to hear the change of bow, but there is some articulations absolutely needed as well as in any languages when the words have to be separated in order to be what you say is understandable. That's how when you hear a foreign language, you don't understand anything because you don't understand when the words end and when the next one begins. Now, the same in music, even small phrases have to have a kind of microscopic separation.
Yes.
And that I learned through her. I'm absolutely through. Yes.
You learned through your wife.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh. And who did she study with? So you both studied with the same teacher?
Georgi Kurtág in Hungary, Dieter Weber in Vienna. Yeah, so that was the let's say the art of phrasing and how your fingering is dependent on the phrasing. And up to a point where when I teach sometimes, I said, tell me your fingering, I tell you your phrasing. You see, fingering and phrasing are absolutely linked.
Wow.
And so yes, so to go back to the last volume, indeed we did this, and we did the concerto for three pianos with one of the ex-students of the school. You have two schools in Manchester. You have RNCM and Cheetham School
Yes,
of Music,
Cheatham's, yeah.
because ex we were recording all this the cycle at the Stoller Hall in Cheetham School,
Okay.
and Rose McLellan is a former
Of course.
student of the Cheetham School of Music, so she accepted to
Oh,
be our
lovely.
third partner for the concerto for three pianos, which usually it's recorded on two, because Mozart made also a version for two pianos of that piece,
Yes.
and there are also the two rondos, the one in D major. Don't ask me the Kirchhell, but they are around 365 or something, and the one
Okay.
in A major, and of course all the ouvertures of the operas that Mozart wrote at the same time, which is, I think, a great idea of this cycle,
Yes.
because the piano concertos are the closest to the operas in Mozart's world, with the difference that there is no words said, and that the piano itself can imitate the voice of any singers, from bass, baritone, to soprano, and so mezzo soprano. So I think it was a really great idea of Gabor to have on the same CD the overtures of the operas Mozart
Yes.
wrote at the same time of the concertos.
That's very interesting.
And it was a 11 years journey, and unfortunately, too bad that Mozart wrote only 30 concertos, because we would have loved to have, maybe we can ask AI to write a few more concertos in the style of Mozart, right?
That's really funny. I mean, you are so utterly busy, Jean-F. Lam. You travel so much, you're recording so much. Is there anything you do to relax away from the piano? Do you have any big hobbies?
I'm happy you asked, but we need to do a complete new podcast for that, because I will be unstoppable thinking of my big passion, which is miniature trains. Yes, I model railroad is really a huge passion of mine. And for the one who are a little bit aware of the size, I'm dealing with a very, very tiny size, which is called the Z scale. It's 220 times smaller than reality. So a finger alone is already a locomotive and one wagon. Yes. So
Oh my goodness.
my tracks are 6.5 millimeters wide.
6.5 millimeters wide, that's tiny.
Yes, my people are 5 millimeters tall, and I paint them. I paint them. I paint even some ties and the hat. Yeah. So, and I have built let's say my kingdom. The great thing is that you need a very, very small space to create something. By the way, it's something that I share with Ravel, who loved miniatures also very much. If you have the chance to visit his house in Montfort-l'Amaury, there is still some object of miniature that like little boat moving on waves in a size
Oh,
of a
beautiful.
matchbox, or little automat, or little things. And so I have a passion for miniatures, and for many years I was traveling with my own train set that I was making, I think, a rather stunning impression on any stewardess in the plane, because I could make my train runs on the
on the table of the plane. You know, I said, "What is that?" And say, "Well, it's a little train." And I had the gold locomotives, and it works on batteries. And yes, I had a lot of fun in planes, making my little
goodness.
Trains running.
Wait, you travel with them, or you've
I
given
did.
up on that?
I did for many years. I did travel with a small train set. Now, it's rather big now. It's in my house in Normandy, but well, it's a kind of therapy actually for me. It really, it helps me to relax and to fall asleep. You know, I think everybody has a kind of protocol in falling asleep, and
Yes.
mine is thinking of my trains. And if I cannot think of my trains before sleeping, it's bad news. It means I'm preoccupied with other things. It's a little bit of a therapy.
And does your wife Andrea share this passion?
No, but she's so devoted to her husband that last time we visited Hamburg, where there is the biggest train set in the world, it's called Miniatur Wunderland. It's a 50 million euros train installation. And believe it or not, I've made her spend 7 hours in that. And that was my fourth visit. And let me tell you, 7 hours is not even enough to see
Oh my
half
goodness.
of it. So
you'll have to go back again on your own.
Oh yes, she dutifully followed me for the 7 hours. But I really recommend anybody, even if you are not so much into miniature trains, it's really worth it. They rebuilt an entire Elbphilharmonie, which opens, and the orchestra is moving in little parts. It's really fascinating.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm absolutely convinced you could spend a whole podcast talking about that. But I guess we need to sign off
Move
on
on.
that. Goodness, I have. There's a lot I'd like to ask you. I mean, you've got this project with Shandos, also the Beethoven Connection. You've done one recording so far, and you're going to be doing another one. Is that correct?
Actually, almost. The second one is already recorded.
Okay.
It will be out, I don't know, the date's swift, but probably, I mean, you probably know better. You're 26, in autumn 26.
Exactly, yes,
okay.
I think so. And this is...
The idea came in 2020 with the Beethoven year, and I was always very interested to rather less known composers, and why? Main question was why Beethoven is so known, and why Ludwig Berger felt completely in the black hole of music history. Why Haydn is so known, and Joseph Wölfel, no, and. You know, all of these questions. What makes the great the greatest, and what is the reason that the others some kind of disappeared more or less? Of course, everybody knows the name of Clementi, of Hummel, of Dussek, but why their music is less played? And so it fascinates me, and that goes back a little bit to what I just said about composing and great ideas. Because I came to the conclusion that having great themes is a wonderful thing, but you don't make a great piece with great themes. Great themes is far not enough to create a masterpiece. It's a little bit as if in a movie industry, you had just a movie with great pictures. Great pictures are needed to make a great movie, but that's not actually what makes a great movie. It's the plot, it's the way the story is said, how do you go from one situation to another, and how the whole film is built in a climax or several climax, the release and the tension that the movie and that the director creates with all the editing process. Well, actually, in composition, it's a little bit the same. And Beethoven is a great example of that. You cannot say that Beethoven is a composer with great themes. Sometimes his themes are in a way, in a the most simple as possible. In a way, we are almost in wonder how could he write such a great piece with a theme that has so little potential, or so little originality. I'm not saying that not. So there are some themes of Beethoven we have which have a great originality, but most of the time they are not. It's the way the music is built, the great vision, the concept that we were referring to when we talk about Ravel, and Clementi, Hummel have great ideas, have great themes. I love their music and sometimes really have a very honest soft spot. Otherwise, I will not spend my time learning their piece and recording them. But what I want to show by that is that it's great music, but it has some great moments. And in a way, I don't want to demonstrate the weak points. That will be too radical for me. But what I want to say, it's a completely different way of thinking in terms of architecture and of the and great picture.
Yes.
Some of the piece, let's say Ludwig Berger, who is I'm not sure if you are familiar with the name. No. I will not be surprised you are not. No. The best student of Clementi, one of the best students of Clementi. And who wrote a sonata, I just record, Grand Sonate Pathétique in C minor, that rings a bell, with exactly the same pattern of the Beethoven Pathétique Sonata Opus 13. But Ludwig Berger is even trying harder because he is putting the slow introduction also at the end of the third movement, a very original gesture that even Beethoven didn't think of it. Because we have the return of the slow largo, in the first movement, but you don't have recall of the first movement in the last movement. Yes. You don't have. Yeah. Ludwig Berger tried, and it's very touching because it works and it doesn't work at the same time. I was really playing the piece and recording the piece with all my soul, and I hope people will hear it and say, "Wow, that's really original. That's really original." And so the volume 2 is about sonata of Clementi, of Hummel, the funeral march that Czerny wrote for Beethoven, very solemn and moving piece, as we know that Czerny was so close to Beethoven, and this sonata of Berger. But there will be certainly a volume 3 and possibly a volume 4, because my dear friend Marc Vignal, Mr. Haydn in France, you have Jeremy Nichols in your country for Debussy and Ravel. So we have Marc Vignal in France for Clementi and Haydn, and he knows what Clementi and Haydn had for breakfast their entire life, and so he's advising me very wisely. What piece to record and so, and it's, yes. So it's a great passion of mine at this moment also.
Oh, I look forward to listening to
it. And on top of it, it makes me also realize the originality of Beethoven.
I'm sure.
And that's the main thing.
Yes. Oh, it sounds fascinating. And I can't wait to listen to it.
You will be surprised.
Good, I'm sure. Now on to some lighthearted questions.
Sure.
I'm going to throw these at you, and if you just reply off the cuff, that'll be wonderful.
Okay,
if you could play only one composer from now on, who would it be?
I stopped playing. Because I think too much of even a great thing kills a great thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So when Richter said, I don't play Beethoven's fourth concerto because I love it, I'm afraid to hate it if I start practicing it.
Oh.
Yes. So I think too much of one thing is not an option. So in that case, I stop playing and I play in my head all the composer I want.
Oh my goodness, what a great original answer. Okay, fair enough. Next question. One pianist, dead or alive, you travel long and far to hear.
Oh, no, I mean, immediately, Liszt, Franz Liszt,
Whoa, great,
of course,
great.
as it, you know that Debussy heard Liszt playing
Oh, how fantastic.
in Rome, 2 years before Liszt passed away, and when Debussy was a composer in residence at the Villa Medici, and so we speak about a 72-year-old Liszt. And Debussy said all his life he never heard piano so well played. We don't know what Liszt played. We still for the pensionnaire of Liszt of the Medici house. We don't know what he played. It must have been some of his last pieces, you know, rather religious and mysterious. Certainly not virtual stuff. But to hear Liszt improvising or sight reading the Schumann Quintet or this concert with when Liszt, oh, I know, the concert I would love to hear is Bach a triple concerto with Hanseld, Chopin, and Liszt at the piano and Mendelssohn conducting. Yes, I think
Oh my goodness.
there is a concert. I'm almost sure it, yes, I hope, I mean, don't quote me completely, but I think there is an amazing concert of Mendelssohn conducting and Liszt and Chopin at the piano or something like that. Okay.
Oh my goodness, with
Next,
Hensel. That
yes.
sounds amazing.
Next question.
Next question. One person, dead or alive, you would like to play for?
I was inclined to say Beethoven, but he will not hear me, so that's not a good answer. I have many ways. Of course, I would let's say Ravel, because an extremely demanding composer, extremely demanding. But I'm not sure it's the one with whom I could learn the most. Because so it's no. Probably. Well, let's say no. I still say Beethoven, but before he can, you know, he lost his
Fine,
hearing.
when he
Yes,
can still hear. Yeah. Okay.
No,
You've learned a lot
Beethoven.
from him. Okay.
Because I have, you know why? Because I have more questions to ask to Beethoven than to Ravel.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Fine. Do you have any technical struggles?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, are you thinking in terms of technique now? If
Technique at the piano.
I'm not terribly good in double thirds. Yes.
Fine,
Yeah.
that's a difficult one.
Okay. And the trills, octave, chords. No. I mean, you would have asked me this question about 30 years ago. I would definitely have telling you octaves because of the functional dystonia, you know, that I had.
Of
Yes, of course. Yes.
course.
So that was a big struggle. Although octaves were my forte at that time. Yeah. So
Oh.
that's another subject. But now time has passed, thank God, and
Yes.
thanks to the help of the right people, thank
Yeah.
God. I thank them here, Mr. Chamagne, especially Philippe Chamagne. But struggle? No, I mean, it's all playing piano is a struggle. To be free, to fly, and to yes, I'm not so much thinking of in terms of technical challenges. But more musical challenges, I think.
I'd actually forgotten you had focal dystonia,
Yes.
but maybe we won't touch on that.
That's
It's seeing its past.
another pod
I'm so
podcast.
glad for you. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, what would be your advice to an amateur pianist on about how to improve?
Oh, definitely not less than 15 minutes a day.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The absolutely constant daily practice is crucial, even if it goes down to 15 minutes. I mean, any physical trainer will tell you that also.
Yeah.
You know, you want to improve your abdominal your muscles. It's always a question of doing it every day. More important than how long. Well, if you can have on weekends 1 hour, wonderful. But if you cannot, I mean, just practicing like 3 hours Saturday and 3 hours Sunday and nothing during the week, you will go nowhere.
Yeah. Yes. That's very, very interesting. I wish. Yeah, it's very important. OK. If you were not a pianist, what would you be?
I would say chef de gare.
Chef de gare? Train, is that train station chief?
Yes. Train station.
Oh, of course. Manager. Of course.
No. I mean, I don't know. Architect is something I was always interested in. Architecture. Okay. Yeah, probably. Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Do you go to a lot of museums, architecture?
Yes. And I came to the conclusion that also in music, the way the piece is built creates an emotion by itself.
So yes.
Do not separate the intellectual and the emotion. The way the piece of music is built, is created, is craft, creates an emotion. A theme and variations doesn't create the same type of emotion than a sonata form.
Yes.
And the same with architecture. The way the building is made and the way the space is thought and organized create an emotion.
Yeah, that's true.
The music in time, architecture in space.
Okay.
But maybe very soon we will discover that time and space are exactly the same.
Mm.
We don't know yet.
We don't. No, interesting. Finally, one composer you're not quite ready to tackle.
Immediately, the first one that comes to mind is Shostakovich.
Oh, okay.
I feel extremely far from his sound world. Extremely far I totally admire the fact that he could create a very distinctive style. Which is, in a way, the trademark of a real genius.
Yes.
But I feel very far to his music. I don't know. It's hard to explain. I feel a little bit as if I am his hostage when I hear a symphony. I can enjoy a symphony. I mean, I enjoy when it's played by with passion and with depth, and when I feel that the players are, you know, emotionally completely connected, but I am not. So I'm not going to play Shostakovich because I will not be a good advocate, and I'm not sure I will pay justice to his music. So yes, so that's, and that is since actually long time, actually almost all my life. My view didn't change so much on him. So that's a composer I will not touch.
Oh, I can understand that. You feel a bit disconnected. Okay. Goodness, Johnny Flam, I have to say, we're near the end. This was so enlightening. There's so much more I could have asked you. Haydn, we didn't discuss Haydn.
Haydn.
You and Haydn. Why don't we finish with how you feel about Haydn?
So, for example, yes, that's very nice, because it's exactly the opposite of Shostakovich. I feel enlightened. I feel more clever when I hear Haydn. He's a composer that challenged my brain, my heart. I can say that from Haydn, I can say that from Stravinsky, and I can say that from Debussy. These three composers are really challenging me. more than the others. It, also intellectually, I love the way he deals with surprise. I admire so much that he almost invented the sonata form, which is basically as inventing the car engine that was for so many years the base of any cars where that was moving. Okay, we have electric cars today, which is a very, very new approach. But before, all the motors had the same four steps that was used for in any model, any genre, even to, from basic auto to Formula One. Well, the yes. Sonata form is exactly the same in music. It's so perfect. Mm. It's so that it was used for centuries, and it's our dear Haydn who somehow invented it and had this idea of having two ideas and then struggling with each other. I love his quartet. I love his symphonies, and the sonatas are like a laboratory of experimentation. And so I'm absolutely fascinating. Oh. And I'm so desperate that I don't have my yearly meeting with Haydn to have another recording of Haydn, because I've done them all. And this is something I'm very proud of, really. And yes. It's a music that is a morning music. Amazing that you should hear in the morning to wake you up, and it puts you in the right mood to feel and to face the world.
Oh my goodness, I tell you, listeners, if you could see Jean F. Lam right now, he's smiling. He's grinning there. Oh, this is such a lovely way to end our conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing this up.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure. I'm sure you're a busy man. I'm speaking to you. You're in France at the moment, I think. Yes. But I wish you all the best, and I'm sure I'll see you very soon.
Thank you, Erika.
And thanks for speaking to us. There's been so much there that everybody will enjoy.
Goodbye to you all. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye. That was the Allegro from Haydn's Sonata No. 1 in G major, and it was performed by Jean F. Lam Bavuzet. Pianist podcasts are free, and a really good way to support what we do is by subscribing to Pianist. Visit our website at pianistmagazine.com and listen to us on YouTube by searching Pianist Magazine. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter, which is full of extra playing tips and useful information. Go to pianistmagazine.com to find out how to sign up.